Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to get ahead in America? Are the systems of our society and economy set up to recognize and reward those with talent? We cherish the idea that ability and initiative matter more than wealth or social class in determining who gets ahead, and we treasure stories of self-made people who have earned their elite status by virtue of inherent gifts and very hard work. But as appealing as such stories are, could it be that they are largely based on myth? Surpassing the socioeconomic circumstances of a disadvantaged upbringing turns out to be far harder than most of us realize, even as a vast safety net protects the not-so-talented or industrious children of the wealthy from descent into poverty. Christopher Hayes is editor-at-large of The Nation and host of MSNBC's Up with Chris Hayes. His new book is called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me. That was a great summary of the book.
Good. Well, you open this book with the sentence, America feels broken. And talk a little bit about what isn't working.
Yeah, I mean, the book began for me out of just it started with two kind of impetuses. One was the sensation that I had just as a person who had lived through the last decade as an adult citizen and just kind of navigating public life. This real profound sense of betrayal and also disorientation. It seemed to me that I just couldn't trust any of the pillar authorities in American life, our pillar institutions. They'd all seemed to have revealed themselves to be corrupt or incompetent or untrustworthy in some way. And then I started to nose around and look at some of the data on polling on this issue, where you ask Americans, you know, how much confidence do you have in the news media, how much confidence do you have in Congress, et cetera, big business and down the line. And what you find is that Americans' trust in their pillar institutions are essentially at an all-time low, with a few notable exceptions. And this, I think, is really the defining feature of American public life at the end of what has been a decade of a lot of crisis and a lot of failure and a lot of catastrophe, is this sense, and it extends across the ideological spectrum, this sense of both betrayal and exhaustion and frustration and skepticism towards those institutions and the elites who run them, who we normally think of as authorities.
And as you mentioned, it's been worse the past decade or so. But what has happened since, say, 1980 that has changed the trajectory of socioeconomic mobility in this country?
So there's a bunch of things, right? So the story about the politics and the economics of inequality and social mobility in the U.S. is a complicated one. But underneath it, I think, is the adoption of a model, a social model that we call the meritocracy, which basically says, look, we're not going to worry about inequality and outcomes, how much people make, for instance, or how far up they ascend, how close people are on the top to those at the bottom. What we are going to worry about is what we call equality of opportunity. That is, we don't want to bar entrance to the American elite based on things like race or religion or gender or geographic background. That's crazy, right? We want everyone to compete on the mythical level playing field. And then there's going to be this process that through competition and these kind of institutions that select out the best and most talented, you're going to winnow down to those folks who will be at the top of our big institutions, run our major banks, be in Congress and the White House, et cetera.
And on the surface, that sounds fantastic. It just doesn't work that way, is what
right,
you're
telling us. That's exactly right. I mean, it is. There's something noble about it. I think it concedes something, I think, that is in tension with our democratic commitment, because it concedes that we want to have rule by some small group of people rather than all of us, which is the basic of our most sort of egalitarian democratic commitment. But if we're going to have an elite, right, this seems like the best way to select it, right? People that deserve it in some sense, that have earned it in some sense. And the fact of the matter is, during the same period of time that we've had that model, we have seen inequality rapidly escalate. And then a less often told story, but in some senses a more important one, is the fact that social mobility has declined. And there's lots of different ways to define social mobility. But for instance, the odds of someone starting in the bottom fifth of the income distribution, born into a family that's in the poorest fifth, and ending up in their life at the top fifth, they're longer now. They're worse odds now than they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So in some profound sense, the meritocracy is failing to deliver on what its foundational and central promise is, right? The idea of that you can go as far as your talent's ability and drive will take you.
And I guess the idea that the reason we want to support this system, even though it turns out not to be working very well, is it that we're convinced of our own specialness and we feel like we're the next ones who will get into that top, you know, fifth or the top 1%, as it were?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good explanation. I think there are kind of two aspects of this. One is folks that ascend through these institutions, and in some senses I'm one of them. It's part of why I wrote the book. I mean, I've been very lucky in being exposed to a number of particularly educational institutions that have given me a whole lot of resources. And and so people that come through those institutions have a tendency, you know, there's a natural tendency to think that a system that has conferred outside benefits on you knew what it was doing, right? Clearly it got it right.
Right.
So there's a sense that the folks at the top, you know, justify the system because it seems like, well, I work pretty hard, I'm really smart, all these people around me are hardworking and smart, so clearly we're getting this right. And then I think for people who are so remote from it, I mean, that's what's the irony of this, is that, you know, we pick out the examples of the kid from a farm in Kansas who ends up at Columbia, or the kid from the Bronx who ends up at Harvard and at Goldman Sachs, but those examples are so rare. But they have such intense salience because it's almost like the lottery. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, people play the lottery not necessarily because they rationally think they're going to win, but because it conjures this possibility of a dream. And so the project of meritocracy and the myth of meritocracy is something very attractive and tangible for folks from all different strata of life, because it makes you think that whatever my circumstances are now, my kid, if they get the right education and have the right drive, they can get to the top.
I've heard that same sort of rationale used to explain people who are in the lower income levels but support, say, tax breaks for the very wealthy, that at some point they feel like they will be in a position to benefit from this.
Yeah, I mean, one of the paradoxes of America in terms of this issue of social mobility is that if you go around the world, and there's actually comparative polling on this, you ask people, how possible is it in your country to start at the bottom, work your way to the top? And you ask people in Korea and in Poland and in France and in Canada and, you know, Brazil and the U.S. The U.S. is essentially at the top in terms of the percentage of people who say, yes, it's very possible in this country to start at the bottom, work your way top. If you look at the actual social mobility, levels of social mobility, again, measured comparatively, we're almost at the very bottom in terms of modern industrialized democracies. So there's this gap, there's this tension between what our self-conception of how mobile a society we have is and what the facts are about it. And in that tension, I think there's a lot of place for frustration, a sense of betrayal, different kind of scapegoats you can blame for the social contract not working, because we don't have a conversation, a political conversation that's very squarely about this central fact.
So, Chris, you write with great candor about your own educational experience, specifically at Hunter College High School, where you did, I guess, your middle school years and also high school. Now, in theory, this is an institution that has tried to eliminate every possible sort of improper influence in its search for the best and brightest students in New York City. Talk about the admissions process and about what that yielded at the time you were in school and about what the student population looks like today.
It's you know, Hunter's a pretty amazing place. It's it's actually the first public school for girls in the U.S., in New York City. And it's a school for the gifted, it calls itself. It's a magnet school where it's free and open to kids from all five boroughs and all, you know, sixth graders who've scored high enough on their recent state testing qualify to take the test. And everyone lines up, you know, from Staten Island, the Bronx, and Queens, and Manhattan, all five boroughs. And you take one test as an 11-year-old. And if you do well enough, you get in. If you don't, you don't. And there's something kind of bracing about this, right? Because, you know, unlike, say, Ivy League college admissions where there's legacies or sports scholarships or even, you know, if your dad happens to give a wing of the library, there's a pretty good chance you're going to get in.
Sure.
It's a pretty ungameable system. I mean, I have every confidence that if Mayor Bloomberg's granddaughter took the test and didn't get in, she wouldn't get in. And there's not a lot of institutions in American life that you can say that about. So in that sense, it preserves this very noble, austere vision of the level playing field. One test, everyone takes the same one, that's it. Mm-hmm. Of course, the problem is that there is really no level playing field. There is no actual equality of opportunity. The kids who are coming to that test as 11-year-olds have vastly, vastly different primary school education backgrounds, resources, access to social capital, etc. And so the school has always underrepresented certain populations, for instance, Black and Latino students. But then on top of that, in the last 15 years, since I was there, there has arisen a test prep industry around entrance to the school. And it's almost inevitable, right? We're in New York City, a lot of people with a lot of money, education's a scarce resource, the education you get at Hunter is remarkable. And so there are now places like Elite Academy in Queens that call themselves cram schools, where you can spend thousands of dollars to send your child for a week during winter break for full-day classes or to go during weekends and afternoons. There are lots of tutors in Manhattan in the wealthier precincts who charge up to $90, $100, $120 an hour. And it's now become the case that the majority of students, as best we can tell from just my interviewing of teachers there, are coming in with some kind of test prep background. And what's happened is the number of Black and Latino students has declined quite precipitously during that same period of time, to the point where recent statistics show an entering class with 3% and 1% respectively. That's in a city that's a majority Black and Latino city, a public school in a city that's a majority Black and Latino city. So you have this issue where, and it's to me a kind of perfect parable of how this clinging to a vision of equality of opportunity just inevitably breaks down, because the mechanisms and the social forces of actual inequality of outcome, people's very disparate levels of financial resources, is naturally going to find ways to game the system, to subvert the mechanisms that you're providing this equality of opportunity. And I think that's a pretty good way of thinking about what's happened to American society writ large.
There's also some interesting questions here about our notions of how we define intelligence and how important that is in terms of ultimate success, because you can do a standardized test for knowledge or intelligence, but it's harder to test for other qualities that might be very important.
Yeah, it's a funny thing about meritocracy, which is that, you know, at a certain level of abstraction, if you say, look, people with the most merit should have the most important positions, you say, well, sure, it's almost a tautological statement. I mean, well, who else should get it, right?
I want my brain surgeon to have been at the top of her class, sure.
Yeah, exactly, right. And my airline pilot, I hope he's really good at flying planes, and on and on and on. You know, it turns out, though, that merit is just a much, much, much more complicated and trickier word and thing to define and measure than it appears when you just toss it out there, you know. And so what ends up happening is it gets defined narrowly. It gets defined in ways that are quantifiable. It gets defined as testing. It gets defined on Wall Street as bonus. I mean, you walk around Wall Street on bonus day. Everyone knows what everyone else got for their bonus because there's this intense gossip mill in which people are finding out what everyone's bonus is, and you figure out where you stack up. And that number becomes synonymous with merit. But, of course, that's a really reductive way of thinking about merit. It's a really reductive way about thinking about leadership, reductive way about thinking about decision-making and what we value in people that we want to have in important positions. Do we want people that are the most cutthroat and make the most money? Do we want people who are, quote, the smartest, as if that's something we can obviously and easily measure and rank, as opposed to other qualities, prudence, wisdom, judgment, compassion, open-mindedness, curiosity? All of those are traits that are very important, I think, in folks that are going to make decisions that have a lot of important effects, but they're traits that are much harder to measure and select for. And I think the system we have in place tends to kind of marginalize the value of those traits.
Christopher Hayes is my guest. He's editor-at-large of The Nation and host of MSNBC's Up with Chris Hayes. His new book is called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. This hour, my guest is Christopher Hayes. He is editor-at-large of The Nation, and he hosts Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. We're discussing this hour his new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So many interesting things presented in this book to think about, Chris. And another is this fascinating fallacy of meritocracy that, in addition to rewarding the strongest members of society, we imagine that it ought to punish the weakest ones. But it turns out the legacy resources that are possessed by the most elite allow them to protect their children from the consequences of their own failures.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that we see just everywhere we look in American life. I mean, in order for a social contract to be to meet, I think, our basic standards of fairness is the idea that it's universally applicable, right? I mean, that if, you know, it doesn't matter who you are and how much privilege you have, or if you, for instance, break the law, you will be held to account. If you lose a lot of money for someone, for instance, if you're a, you know, everyone knows what it's like to, or have someone they know in their life who's been chased by a creditor for something, and you're going to have to pay up or have your credit ruined. And what we see almost everywhere we look is that American society looks incredibly relentlessly punitive on the bottom and remarkably forgiving on top. I mean, just something as simple as our criminal justice system, which puts more people in prison than essentially any other industrialized democracy, almost per capita more than any other country in the world. You know, if you're a 16-year-old kid of color in New York and you get caught on a stop and frisk with a little bit of marijuana, you're now in the system. There are a lot of kids with privilege in Ivy League universities with the same amounts of marijuana. In fact, we actually know for a fact that drug use among black and white people is essentially the same, and yet rates of incarceration are wildly disparate.
So the white kids get drug treatment and the black kids go to jail.
Right. I mean, as an oversimplification, yes. I mean, that is what the probabilities say. And something is, you know, when we think about criminality, I mean, think about the fact that we've had more baseball players before juries for lying about steroids than we have had major bankers before juries for what was the largest Ponzi scheme basically in American history, the securitization machine that ran the housing bubble and resulted in the crash. And I think there's something just fundamentally unjust about that, and it calls into question the whole system.
And I get the issue of it being unjust. I have to tell you, though, as a parent, and I know that you're a parent yourself, I would want to protect my children from their own failures and use whatever I've earned to try to make their way a little easier, as I think parents would on every level of social stratification in the country.
That's, I think, exactly right. And I think that's precisely the natural process that is why we can't ignore the absolute levels of inequality. I mean, it gets back to the Hunter test, right?
Yeah.
I don't fault parents for sending their kids to test prep at all. I mean, it's a perfectly rational instinct to do. You want your kid to get a good education. You, as a parent, have a loyalty to your child and your child's prospects that is not, you know, diluted by largely social concerns, I mean, except in some rare cases, you know. And so that's why, because of that inevitable pressure, because of the inevitable gravity of that, that's why having a society that is more equal in absolute terms is going to help mitigate against some of these impulses.
So is it possible that this concentration of power and ultimately oligarchy is simply a factor of human nature and something we don't have much control over?
You know, I'm sort of simultaneously an optimist and a pessimist on this. So mm-hmm. I actually take a kind of conservative and pessimistic approach just about what human nature and the nature of organizations, institutions, societies, and even democracies is, which is, yes, the natural state of power is the natural equilibrium towards which institutions, organizations, and democracies tend is concentration of power, is a small amount of people wielding a lot of power. And that's something that different social critics have written about in different ages and all sorts of different systems, from the Greeks and the Romans through the, you know, critics in the Industrial Revolution. What's remarkable to me is that there's a countervailing dynamic process of democratization that America has gone through in multiple different cycles where we have pushed against certain oligarchies, certain concentrations of power, whether it was the slaveholding class of the southern plantations, whether it was the trusts of the Gilded Age, whether it was the bankers in the wake of the New Deal or the Jim Crow South, that we have found different ways through movements and through laws to constantly engage in this dynamic process of diffusing power, and then it collects again, and we have to break it up and diffuse it again. And I just think we're at one of those moments in American society where we're reaching a point where we can't ignore anymore the degree to which power and influence has collected in a relatively small group of hands and need to kind of initiate a real, full, honest national conversation about what to do about it.
This also is a great time to discuss the differing strategies and differing outcomes of groups like the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. Both of them came in and didn't necessarily have a clear hierarchy, but the people at the Tea Party decided to mobilize, at least to the extent that they would choose candidates, mount candidates, and in fact have had great success. And the people with Occupy Wall Street have this sort of inchoate idea that something is not working, but they haven't really been able to do much about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it has to do with a whole bunch of preconditions about where each of those movements are drawing their strength from, and part of it has to do with the ways in which the Tea Party was very strategic about marshaling its force in a very specific electoral way, and the electoral strategy they used were primaries. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, that's what it culminated in 2010, was a series of primary challenges to Republican Party incumbents. And some of them didn't work, and we spent a lot of time, you know, in Delaware, for instance, Christine O'Donnell talking about that, Sharon Angle in Nevada. But a lot of them did work, and even the ones that didn't work really shook up the folks in the Republican Party, and it created genuine leverage and power in the political system. Now, the big question to me about whether the Tea Party is successful or not, in a deep sense, it's very easy for them to be quote-unquote, successful in opposition. But, you know, we have this conversation in America, particularly every election season, and this election season, I think, more than recent ones, where the choices are presented as this grand ideological choice between different visions of government, the size and role of government, and, you know, small government and more freedom and more left to the market on one side, that's conservatives and Republicans, and bigger government and more redistribution and regulation, and that's the Democrats. And it just flies in the face of what the actual historical record is. I mean, you know, we recently had a long period of Republican governance. It was the same Republican Party. It was, you know, run by a lot of the same people. And government as a percentage of GDP did not shrink. In fact, it went up. Deficits went up as well. Spending went up. Spending went up in all sorts of different categories. And it's very hard for me to see why we should actually buy into this framework that there is this grand ideological vision, because to me it's much more about who government will work for than its size and what it will do. And the big test for the Tea Party to see if it's actually been successful or just symbolically successful is whether the Republicans, if given full power, revert to form, the form that they took under George W. Bush and Tom DeLay, which was things like the Medicare Part D, you know, prescription deal that was a huge boon for pharmaceutical companies and also created this new entitlement for seniors.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Michael in Dallas. Hey, Michael.
Hello. This is really interesting, and as I've been listening, my question has changed a little bit. But what got me interested was talking about the school where the guest went to school in New York. And, you know, I'm not sure what I would like to see more schools like that. The way the education system has gone in this country and how far behind we are compared to other countries, I want as many schools as possible that take the very, very brightest kids and encourage them as much as possible to advance in science and whatever. But then also I was thinking about that and thinking about this whole meritocracy idea and all the power that's in so few hands. It's all mostly related to money, and the scientists that are the elite in America right now are kind of on the opposite side from that power group in many, many ways. And so I just would like to hear his response to those two thoughts. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Those are both great, great points. Let me take the second point first, because I think it's a really interesting one. I did an interview about the book with someone who, Chris Mooney, who's a writer about science and does a science podcast, and he said, what about science? You know, science actually has seen some erosion in its trust and confidence in American life, and yet scientists doesn't seem like science is failing in the same way that other institutions are. And he actually made the case, and I thought it was in some ways a somewhat persuasive one, that science is a place where genuine meritocracy still functions fairly well. And partly that's because of there's a certain egalitarian ethos at the core of science, its openness, its combative critical nature, where anyone can criticize anyone else. And there's much less distance between different scientists than there is, in, say, between, you know, a poor janitor in New York and someone who works on Goldman Sachs. So I think that science as an institution, it's not something I've written that much about or even reported about that much in the book, but I think science is an interesting counterexample to some of the theories that I have in the book, and it's something I want to think about more. In terms of my alma mater, Hunter, you know, I actually kind of agree with the caller. I would like there to be more Hunters, and that gets in some ways to a larger point about how we conceive of the social model. You know, one of the things that is implicit when we think about our social model and meritocracy is that scarcity at the top. So the idea is that if you scratch the surface of what we're actually thinking about when we're thinking about our kids, right, and our kids' success, and particularly this kind of hyper-competitiveness you can see and neuroses around the development of children among a certain cohort of Americans, it's the idea that there's only a small number at the end of the process, there's only a small number of good jobs and fulfilling lives. And that just seems a bizarre bankrupt social model in a country that is one of the wealthiest in the history of human civilization. I mean, there should be ample supply of well-paying jobs and fulfilling lives. And that was, in some ways, the vision of the middle part of the century. The post-war boom was about a certain kind of expansive middle-class affluence, and that had its own problems in all sorts of ways. But it didn't engender this sense of scarcity and competition in the same way. And I think reclaiming that, or even having just an explicit argument about what exactly do we think should be the case about what percentage of jobs can, for instance, sustain a kind of modicum of comfort and affluence and, a home and vacation and things like that. You know, we don't have that conversation. And the way that relates back to Hunters is that I actually agree. I would like there to be more Hunters because I would like there to be less scarcity in terms of this competition for this very valuable good.
Let's talk about CEO compensation, which is something that's been such a hot button issue for the past couple of years. In the mid 70s, it was like 35 times the average company wage for most corporations. Today, the average is upwards of 275 times above average wage, and often not tied in any way to the performance of the company itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, if you spend time looking at CEO compensation, you come away thinking the system is pretty rigged and corrupt, or at least I did. I mean, there's a woman named Nell Minow who has been writing about this and covering it for years. You know, one of the points she makes is that there's all sorts of short-term incentives for CEO pay. Hitting these quarterly numbers. Second of all, a lot of times CEOs and the management team can negotiate for themselves performance bonuses if they hit certain benchmarks, but they're the ones submitting the benchmarks.
That's a good, so, you know, if you can
like
get that
if
job.
If I told you anything I run under a 20-minute mile, you got to pay me $1,000, right? I mean, I know I can run under a 20-minute mile. So you have that feature. You also have the fact that often a lot of CEO compensation is tied to stock options increasingly, and that's part of certain reforms that happened in the 1980s and 90s. Stock options don't reflect the specific performance of a firm as much as they reflect the macro trends that are driving the stock market in general. And most stock options and compensation packages don't distinguish between the two. So if you just happen to be the CEO of a company during a four-year period in which the Dow is growing overall because GDP growth is high and lots of money is flowing into the financial sector, like, say, during the tech bubble in the late 1990s, you're going to be compensated wildly, even if your firm itself is not doing very well compared to, say, its competitors as a benchmark, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this way in which a lot of CEO compensation, particularly during times of appreciating stock prices, is just basically being able to capture the value of a stock market that is doing well overall. And then finally, CEO compensation is this, you know, talk about small world. I mean, CEO compensation is often negotiated, almost always negotiated, by a compensation committee that's a subcommittee of the board. And on those compensation committees are often CEOs of other firms. So, you know, you have a system in which you have a bunch of CEOs who are coming up with what the compensation packages for other CEOs is going to be. I mean, if you had a world in which, you know, freelance writers got to decide what other freelance writers were going to make, you would see the salary of freelance writers go up, I would imagine.
It's interesting because when you talk about, you know, if you happen to be a CEO during a four-year period where the Dow is just booming, you end up benefiting from that. It sounds not so very different from happening to be an elected official during a similar period.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, that in some ways is a tougher problem, right? Because, you know, the way that democracy works is that we you know, at their most basic levels, elections often tend to be referenda on the status quo and the direction that people feel things are moving. You know, it's hard to think of how we would kind of create some sort of index, some index or some performance benchmarks, because, you know, democracy ends up being a very complicated argument about performance. But we don't, the thing is that we don't think of, or at least CEOs and others would like us to not think of CEO compensation as such an obviously nakedly political or a political process, or a process that's so guided by happenstance and luck and being in the right place at the right time. If you talk to CEOs, they will tell you that they are masters of the universe and that their judgment-making and vision is why they're earning the big bucks.
My guest is Christopher Hayes. He's editor-at-large of The Nation and host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. His new book is called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. We'll continue the conversation in a moment. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Christopher Hayes. His new book is called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Chris, you've identified two basic categories of people who are searching for ways to address what's not working in our meritocracy. There are institutionalists and there are insurrectionists. Talk about how their approaches to reform differ.
Yeah, I mean, I think institutionalists are those who see the, you know, who think that it's not necessarily a problem of the institutions or the elites or inequality so much as that it's that the trust of the people has evaporated, and that trust has been eroded by a lot of cynicism and the 24-hour cable news cycle and an underappreciation of the elites and how hard they work or how good their decisions are, and then also a lack of kind of institutional pride by the elites themselves. And you know, David Brooks is probably the most, I would say, articulate, well-known writer who writes in this vein. In fact, he wrote an op-ed just last week about my book, in which he critiqued it in precisely this way. And so there are folks who I think, you know, we need people to trust these institutions. We need the elites who helm them to be kind of more self-consciously elitist and steward those institutions better, and that's how we can get out of this morass. And then the insurrectionists think the system's bankrupt and that these institutions don't deserve to be trusted, they don't deserve their authority, that they're fundamentally broken, that they need to be fundamentally reformed in some deep ways. And that impulse is, again, one that extends across, I mean, you find institutionalists on both the left and the right, and you find insurrectionists on both the left and the right. It's a different way of kind of conceiving of how people respond to the crisis of authority.
Of course, you set this dichotomy up, and I think to myself, oh, great, one more way we can polarize America.
I don't think it has enough, visceral appeal to people to that it'll be polarizing or people will self-consciously think of this way. I just think it's useful sometimes because I think if you think of people in these terms or you think about debates in these terms, it could sort out sometimes debates that get very confusing. When we talk about reform, we talk about the Senate filibuster, for instance, in which you have, you know, people on both sides of the ideological spectrum making similar arguments because they're on different sides of the institutionalist or insurrectionist divide, right? Mm-hmm. How bankrupt is the institution of the Senate? How much does it need to be reformed? And so if you think about things in those terms, it can make sense sometimes of debates or conversations that don't seem to make sense on other, you know, if you view them through other lenses.
So some of these issues would seem to scream for grassroots activism and people who really want to change the way the meritocracy works, taking this into their own control. But there are certain problems we face, Chris, that really can't be solved from the ground up necessarily.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the problem, well, I'm a big believer in solving things from the ground up, but I think there's, you know, when you talk about, for instance, climate change, and that's something I write about a fair amount in the book, and it's the concern that I have and the challenge we face that most inspires my own, say, institutionalist sympathies, because you worry about a landscape where all institutional authority has been leveled, and no one trusts anyone. And so when the quote-unquote experts say that the Earth is warming, people say, screw you. What are you talking about? Why should I listen to you? And that's, you know, problematic for a lot of reasons. Climate change is one of these problems that it requires, in a way other problems don't, it requires a kind of mediation, right? If you are living in a neighborhood that has a lot of crime, you don't need someone to tell you that crime is a problem in your neighborhood. If you are living in Youngstown, Ohio, where unemployment is very high and the economy is suffering, you do not need anyone to tell you that unemployment is high and the economy is suffering. But no one is equipped to register what are essentially imperceptible changes in global average temperatures over a long period of time. And so there's a certain amount of elite mediation that is necessary and central to coming to grips with the problem of climate, that you wonder if it's possible to have it in place under the current conditions. Now, having said that, we talked about climate and weather and the relationship between the two on my show a few weekends ago. We had Bill McKibben on, and he's a writer who's written about the climate as much as anyone. He also founded a group called 350.org. And he was saying, look, if the weather keeps acting crazy, you won't have to convince people. It will do the job for you. So maybe, you know, you don't need this middleman. Maybe, you know, as the climate wreaks havoc with our weather, people will see what's happening firsthand, and it will be like crime or unemployment where we get this kind of grassroots backlash, this grassroots push to do something.
We have an email here from Emily in Denton who wants to know your opinion with regard to all this on affirmative action, whether that would lead to a better level playing field.
Yeah, I mean, I support affirmative action, and I think there's all kinds of different ways to think about affirmative action. I think there's affirmative action for along racial lines, which has been quite circumscribed both by policy drift and also some court decisions. We just don't see as much of that as we used to. I would favor affirmative action also along economic lines, where we, particularly in educational systems, we boost applications of students who are coming from poor backgrounds of whatever racial origin. And the reason, I think, is because it's one way to mitigate some of these impulses. What's really fascinating to me, though, is that we have rolled the clock back on all of that. I mean, even as the system's getting less and less equal, even as, say, wealth between African-American, the median African-American wealth and median white family wealth diverges more and more, we are getting rid of the policies of affirmative action that we used to kind of take for granted as part of what providing a level playing field or shooting for a level playing field would look like. even Hunter, I mean, this is a fascinating detail. You know, Hunter itself, back in the 1980s, used to have some kind of affirmative action in place in which students from who were Black or Latino who had scored just below the threshold would gain admittance to the, and then have and be enrolled in a summer school and kind of get a little extra prep to give them a leg up as they went in. And that has been discontinued. That's a relic. That happened 20 or 30 years ago. So what's fascinating to me is that at the same time that we're seeing more and more inequality and less mobility, the policies that we used to marshal to address this problem are increasingly rare.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Christine on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Thank you so much for having this discussion. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I attend one of the, I guess, quote-unquote, elite universities, and I was wondering about kind of the mistaken notion that a lot of parents have in regard to their children of if you just work hard enough and you have high enough test scores, then you'll kind of make it into that elite bracket, and then you'll have one of the, you know, small number of jobs, the dearth of jobs. I was wondering how that, if that's, you think it's true as you had your experience being a fellow at Harvard, and or do you think that there are other kind of immovable factors and the institutions themselves are just kind of holding places for an elite that we don't, like most people, couldn't even identify?
Oh, I mean, I think it's much more the latter, and part of the point of the book is to say that. I mean, I think that the point is that whatever we say, you know, when I'm talking about meritocracy, when I'm talking about describing the system as it's as an abstract, as a goal, as an ethos, as a model, rather than what it looks like in reality. And what it looks like in reality is something like much more aristocratic, something much more oligarchic, something much more like the perpetuation of elites, of folks with a lot of resources and power and money, using those resources and power and money to give advantages to their kids and passing along those resources and advantages and money. And the degree to which success, however we define it, particularly in the American sense of, you know, money or fame, to the degree to which success is born of talent is less often the case, I think, than we'd like to tell ourselves. A lot of times it's born of luck. A lot of times it's born of privilege. A lot of times it's born of, sometimes it's born of just outright corruption. I think there's a huge distance between the story we tell ourselves about this kind of process of ascending through American hierarchy and the reality of it.
What can we do to create better systems for identifying and cultivating talent from among the lower social rungs?
You know, I've thought about this. I mean, there are things you can do, but I think that in some ways is the wrong approach to the problem, because I think what you need to think about is what a more... I think that if you concede the basic framework of meritocracy, one of the arguments of the book is that you will inevitably get this kind of corruption. You will inevitably get this kind of breakdown that I describe. You have to think in much more straightforwardly egalitarian terms. I mean, you know, we should have, you know, high-quality, well-resourced public goods for people of all backgrounds that everyone participates in. And there's just fewer and fewer things like that in American life as you think about it. I mean, something like, for instance, the state university systems, which in the 60s and 70s in California, for instance, were a huge, amazing engine of social mobility. You know, what we're seeing across the country is these universities having their budgets cut, having their tuitions and fees hiked, becoming more and more competitive and harder to get into. So, you know, University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, which is a huge school, is admitting fewer and fewer percentage of its applicants every year as, again, this kind of competition for scarce resources revs up. So I think we need to think about providing public goods that give people, everybody, a kind of equal endowment, and also reducing inequality. And that, you know, here I've become a boring conventional liberal, but I think boring conventional liberalism has it absolutely right in this respect, which is, you know, we need to tax people with a lot of money much more than we do. We need to have a social system that redistributes that money in certain ways. And we need to have a society where we all have a closer purchase to each other than we do now. I mean, there are things like public libraries and public schools, and here in New York City, the subway system, that everybody uses across different class lines. But there are fewer and fewer of those things in American life as we go along. It gets more and more stratified. We are more and more segregated from each other by class, by political and tribal and religious affiliation. And one of the big ways to counteract it, rather than thinking about how to make the meritocracy better or more meritocratic, is to envision a society that is just less focused on this selection process for the few and more focused on providing a good life to the many.
So what does, so let's just assume for the sake of this discussion, I don't know that you would argue with me, that you are, in fact, an entrenched member of the elite. Why do you not suffer from the kind of blinders that you describe in other people, or that sense that you're special?
You know, I don't think I don't suffer from it. I just think I'm sort of self-conscious about it. I mean, I think that, you know, I think there's certain natural psychological issues at play, which is why, you know, it doesn't come down to who these people are. It comes down to, you know, the system that they're in. I mean, in my case, right, I'm young and have spent, you know, most of my adult life as basically a struggling freelance writer, not making very much money. And
so you've lived the other half, yeah.
I mean, that, you know, and I come from the Bronx, where my dad was a community organizer, so there's a certain degree to which that's as much the life that I've known. You know, maybe I'll be completely insufferable and out of touch in 20 years. but I think some of these processes are inevitable, and so we can't rely on the kind of farsightedness of folks who are at the top, because that farsightedness is going to be naturally circumscribed and naturally confined by their position. We need to create systems that keep elites accountable as much as possible. You know, here's a perfect example. I mean, for folks in the media, there's something that's happened which is remarkable, which is, you know, before, say, the internet, particularly before Twitter, I would do a television show, and then I'd get off, and then I'd go home, and that would be it. And the staff would say, oh, this worked or that worked, and we'd come back the next day. You know, now there's this unbelievable amount of feedback from viewers. I mean,
yeah,
thousands and thousands of tweets. That's exactly the kind of thing you'd want, right? I mean, I did an interview yesterday that people were killing me for. They hated the interview. And, you know, those mechanisms of accountability are really important. We don't have them in a lot of other places, right? We don't have just something as simple and visceral as that, as you know, the viewers actually telling you, this is what I thought about what you did yesterday and how you did your job.
I have to jump in here because we are out of time. The new book by Christopher Hayes is called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. Chris, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think and find out about upcoming programs online at kera.org/think, where you can also download the free daily podcast. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, pass those along at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.